Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. And by the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. How is growth in China changing life in the U.S.? China's low-cost manufacturing and hyper-competitive business practices are making consumer items ever more affordable for American buyers. But does our way of life depend too heavily on cheap Chinese goods? And does a stronger Chinese economy threaten U.S. dominance on a global scale? Journalist Ted C. Fishman explores the impact of China's explosive growth in his best-selling book, China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. It's now out in paperback. Ted, welcome to Think.
Glad to be with you, Chris. Thanks.
You have said that it is wise for America to fear China to the extent that it allows us to really be prepared for and deal with whatever challenges its growth presents. What are the biggest challenges as you see them?
Well, the biggest challenge is that the economic footprint of China will give China all kinds of powers in the global economy, which it still doesn't have. It will have pricing power in commodities. It will have market power because of its domestic consumers. And there are many advantages we get from being the economic superpower now. We set standards for technology. Our consumers drive the way. The world wants the American style of consumer lifestyle. But, you know, historically, China's been a very, very good promulgator of Chinese values. I mean, there's a reason why Chinese characters are the characters of choice in languages in Asia. China is capable of having an enormous cultural and economic influence, and we have to be at the very, very top of our game to both take advantage of China's rise and to make sure that our status is secure.
When you talk about Americans setting the standard for technology, one place where China seems to lag behind is in research and in innovation. What do you think are the reasons for that, despite their education?
Well, part of it is just time. There is this generational gap that Chinese communism under Mao created because the school system there was designed around party ideology. And if you take any mature profession in the West, like architecture, medicine, there is a missing generation in China. So they have to catch up, and they are working very, very hard to catch up. The university system in China now graduates more people than the university systems in the United States and India put together. It doesn't mean they're top quality global graduates yet, but one thing that the Chinese economy teaches everyone who does business there is that Chinese people learn, and they learn quickly, and they're highly motivated.
What are the pros and cons from an economic perspective of the fact that China really doesn't enforce any intellectual property laws?
That, to me, is the number one challenge we face. You know, we've made this deal, Chris, where the United States will lead the world's knowledge economy if we can, and if we're allowed to do that, we'll jettison the low-cost jobs, the low-cost manufacturing jobs. China has a kind of de facto policy, which is to acquire the world's finest technology at no cost or little cost through appropriating it, piracy. And it's part of the Chinese economic miracle. And right now there is a kind of big public effort to secure intellectual property in China with Chinese laws, but it's very, very targeted. It protects the top tier of Chinese technology, as small as it is. It protects the technology of companies that can spend lots and lots of money in China working the system. But by and large, it is still a pirated economy. You know, we see it with handbags, DVDs, pirated DVDs, and now you see it with medicines, this heparin scandal in which counterfeit heparin, and one of the key ingredients in heparin, the blood thinner, has been commingled with the global supply and is causing deaths in the United States, and some worrying signs in Germany is part of this problem in China. But one of the things that I think is scary for us is that on the intellectual property front, China shows how its standards, its lower standards, can be exported abroad. We always think that China is going to find the rule of law, find democracy the way we want it to, but often what we find is the lack of transparency, the willingness to circumvent international norms is being exported out of China. So sometimes I go into Chinese factories that are run by American companies, they've just been set up, and you walk in and you see, oh, there's a couple fantastic Swiss machines or Japanese machines that are very, very expensive to import into China for the foreign manufacturer. And they said, yeah, we're just getting started. We're really excited about our prospects there. And you go back 18 months later, and the place is humming, and there are dozens and dozens of these machines. And you say, wow, you've really done a great job building your business. How's the cost going with these expensive machines here? And they say, oh, these aren't the machines you saw before. We took those machines to a Chinese manufacturer and had them re-engineered.
They copied what they had.
So the Westerners are having their expensive machines copied in China. And that way, you know, this is part of the low-cost miracle in China. So the companies that complain most about their own products being pirated go to China, set up manufacturing, and use pirated means of production from the people who supply them.
In other cases, there are things in Chinese manufacturing that are not mechanized, as they would be in factories in most other parts of certainly the developed world. I wonder if you can talk about how labor, in many cases, is still cheaper than a pirated machine to do a similar job.
Oh, absolutely. One of the ways that you re-engineer the workplace in China, especially in light manufacturing, is you take out the capital-intensive machinery and you replace it with people who are very good at fine motor skill demanding jobs. And so companies that sell industrial machinery into China often find that they don't have to sell their latest generation. They have to rework a production line so that you can insert people back into the production line. So if you go into a Chinese workplace, it looks like a whole village is there. You know, there are factories with 200,000 or more people there. If you go into an advanced factory in the United States, you know, particularly these factories that supply the auto industry and the farm implement industry in the Midwest, there's nobody in the factory. It really looks like a ghost town because it's all automated. And yet the Chinese factories are newer. Right? And they're newer, and they're, in a way, you could say that they're going backwards because they're taking advantage of low-cost labor.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, certainly the labor force will always be there, but at some point it will get cheaper. Won't it to put a machine in there? And I have to wonder if that's not going to be an extraordinary threat to the growth of the Chinese economy if you know, 80% of those jobs are either exported or replaced by machines.
Yeah, I think it is a threat to the economy. It's not just because the machines are cheaper. It's also because people's standards go up. And machines get smarter. So, you know, automation improves the quality in virtually everything. But there are ways in which you can wed automation with labor. So if you look at a skyscraper in China, it's very, very low-skilled labor being used to make that skyscraper. But the materials going into it are highly engineered in factories in order for these low-cost laborers to, in essence, snap together a high-rise. And so the materials, in a way, you get this dynamic where low-skilled, low-cost labor is driving higher and higher technology because you want to put in very easy but sophisticated materials into the hands of people with a low skill set.
You brought up Mao earlier, and you have a really interesting concept as to how actually Maoist oppression really led to the kind of very capitalist society that you see emerging today in China. And not to certainly defend Mao, but can you talk about how one has progressed to the other?
Yeah, this is fascinating. You know, China does have these very, very large factories, mostly populated with rural migrants who have come into urban industrial China. If you look around other countries, I lived in Indonesia for a long time. You know, it was very politicized in the 60s, pretty chaotic. You have big factories, but they don't operate in the way that China can. They don't get up to speed as quickly. The workers aren't as easily self-disciplined. Because under Mao, this party tried to create a rural workforce that could be easily mobilized, and that's the communist term, easily mobilized into industrial tasks and mass mobilized. So moved from the farm into tasks and then into the next task that the party would assign them. And, you know, the world of business that comes to China to have mass production now benefits from this legacy.
The disciplined workforce that's there to work.
That's right.
We heard just this week that China has announced it's going to up its military spending for 2008 by 18% more than it had planned even before. A lot of estimates say that's still lower than what they're spending. Should we interpret that as a sign that they're trying to defend what they're growing or that they have more aggressive intentions?
Well, there's a lot of concern about the Chinese military in the United States. I think the chief concern in the Pentagon is that the spending simply isn't transparent. We shouldn't be too concerned about their spending in relation to our spending. You know, our incremental budget reauthorizations for supporting the war in Iraq and for our defense establishment are far greater than the entire Chinese defense budget. And most of China's security needs are still domestic. Having said that, though, there is no reason why we should expect anything except that the world's largest country will want a military commensurate with its population and with its geopolitical status. It wants to be a Pacific power, probably sticks in its craw that the United States is the only Pacific power right now, and it will have a military that can challenge any military in the world. It's inevitable. And we can beat our shoes on tables as long as we want about it, but we ought to just face up to it. It's going to happen, and we have to navigate that very, very skillfully.
When you say that most of China's security concerns are domestic, that is certainly an understatement, if nothing else. Can you talk about the things within China that could potentially slow or even threaten the kind of growth that we're seeing right now?
The biggest challenge in China is the nature in which the wealth has unfolded since market reform.
Urban versus rural?
It's urban versus rural, but it's also very much in the hands of the powers that be. The economic players that matter in China are the ones that are connected to the government. And they are the ones that have the permitting for construction, the licensing deals for all kinds of businesses. They're the ones that control key strategic industries. And there is dissatisfaction with this. You know, a friend of mine said, you know, Deng Xiaoping had this famous saying, you know, it doesn't matter if the cat is black or white so long as it catches mice, which means it doesn't matter what economic system you have as long as, you know, people are fed. But he said what Deng Xiaoping didn't say is that some cats are tigers and some are house cats. And in China, the government is the tiger and everyone else is the house cat. And, you know, the house cats are getting ornery about that.
How has the one-child generation changed the way Chinese people think about their futures and what it is they want for themselves?
Well, when you wed the one-child policy with economic development, you get a system in which that one child leaves the farm and goes to the city. So it has separated the distance between parent and child. And it's done a number on filial piety in China. Because as you get that geographic distance and then the economic relationship inverses, where the younger generation is the wealthier generation, you get a very sad story for the elder generation in China. But you get a very, very aggressive concentration of youth in China's cities. So China has because of the one-child policy, China is aging faster than any country in the world. But because of economic development, it has youthful cities that are surpass its rivals anywhere else in the world. And you have this kind of split dynamic. You have this vast, vast country of old people, and you have young cities that the rest of the world wants to take advantage of.
The World Bank this week cut its projections for growth in China. The entire globe is seeing sort of a slowdown. Does that cut in projections mean that there's not a bubble on the horizon expanding in China that we need to worry about?
Wen Jiabao at the Party Congress this week also said that he wants to take measures to slow down China's economy down from over 11% down to 8%. This is a trope that's trucked out every single year. The World Bank always lowers its projections. China always says we're not going to achieve this growth, and it's always an open question whether anybody takes it seriously. They seem to always surpass their numbers the year before. And what hasn't happened in China, which is happening now, is that the domestic consumer is showing up and adding far more to the Chinese economy than the export economy. Last year, The export economy in China just added around 3 percentage points to the gross domestic product, but the consumer, the domestic consumer in China, added 9 percentage points. And we haven't even seen where the Chinese domestic consumer is going to go. It's a very, very new movement, and I think we can only imagine how large it's going to be as a factor influencing the Chinese economy.
Is there reason to suspect that as Chinese consumers have more money to do things and more products available to them, that they're going to want to work less? They're going to want to take this leisure, these leisure items that they purchase and use leisure time, and that somehow the work ethic will be fundamentally changed by prosperity?
Yeah, they'll want to work less, but hopefully there'll be an environment which allows them to be more productive, too. And there's still hundreds of millions of people who haven't made the trek into the present yet. And they will be hardworking and probably keeping a fire stoked under the ones who are thinking of working less. China will be a hardworking economy for the foreseeable future.
And at the end of this century, what do you see the relationship between China and the U.S. economically?
In 92 years from now?
Yeah. Or you can go out less than that if you want to. It's a long time.
Well, look, since just making the analogy with our own economy, since the end of the Civil War, we've had every disaster you could throw at an economy. A bigger disaster set than anyone imagines for China. We've had depression, epidemics, a political tumult, labor union strife, everything. And our standard of living has gone up more than 30-fold. China's going to have disasters. Maybe one will be in the near term. But the free market cat is out of the bag, and it's up and up and up. And they have between 1.3 to 1.6 billion people there. Their economic footprint will inevitably be quite a bit larger than ours. And our job as a country will be to lasso our fortunes to China's and bring ourselves up as they rise.
Ted, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Ted Fishman's book, China Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World, is out now in paperback. Just ahead on Think on the Job and Still in the Nest, how people born after 1980 are changing the American workplace. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Sea calendar for this weekend features A Calling of the Clans, Internet Iconography, and Crazy Castaways. Rover Drama Works invites you to sit right back and hear the rollicking tale of the fateful trip of the SS Minnow and the Texas premiere of Gilligan's Island the Musical on stage at the Cox Building Playhouse in Plano. Opening at the Bathhouse Cultural Center, it's the annual Outside the Lines Juried Exhibition, a showcase of contemporary works from over 40 local and regional artists in a variety of media. The Andor Gallery opens show number 17 with the latest from Brooklyn computer artist and performer Corey Archangel and Stuttgart-based team Olia Lia Lina and Dragan Espenschied. And for a Highland Fling, head to UT Arlington's Maverick Stadium for the 22nd annual Texas Scottish Festival and Highland Games with the best in Celtic sounds, fun for the wee ones, and world-class brawn. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
When's the last time your boss thanked you for being at work? While showing up is perceived by baby boomers and even Gen Xers as the very least one can do, many say their colleagues born after 1980 are arriving at their first jobs with unrealistic expectations about what work really means. Older workers complain that despite its amiability, tech savvy, and stellar education, the millennial generation has been overpraised, overparented, and underprepared to handle constructive criticism or genuine responsibility. But are those fair criticisms? Cheryl Hall is business columnist for the Dallas Morning News. She wrote a series of articles about how millennials are faring in their workplace debuts. Cheryl, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Obviously, any discussion of a generation is going to require gross generalizations, but in general, what makes these millennials different from baby boomers and Gen Xers?
Well, partly is that we've made them, the Gen Xers and the baby boomers have made them what they are today, which is indulged, not spoiled, highly educated, but not really all that prepared for taking responsibility for failure on the job, and we've given them awards for showing up, participation, And they think that that's what works in a workplace, and it doesn't always.
And there are even parents of these young adults negotiating their children's jobs and saying, why did you fire my daughter?
Yes, and I heard from one HR director who said that actually they are being encouraged to bring in parents on job reviews. The company is required. And this unnamed HR director thought that this was pretty nuts.
You interviewed someone for your piece who is called a certified reality therapist, which,
yes,
by the way, is the best title I think I've ever heard. She talked about the need to invest in millennials, not money so much as time to help them build the skills they need.
Mentoring. Mm-hmm. And they want mentoring. They're used to being taught. And that's one of the issues when they get into the workplace. There's nobody really telling them the rules. We expect them to know the rules. And so one of the things that she's telling employers is that set out the rules in advance. Tell them what's expected of them. They are very goal-oriented. So lay out the goals. We inherently learned them. We watched our parents, baby boomers, of which I'm a part, watched our parents try to get ahead in terms of what we did as a middle-class family. You, a Gen Xer, were hedged in by us and the millennials, and you're sort of the middle children, and you've been very aggressive in obtaining success and fighting hard. You were the first generation to have the moms enter the workplace. So you have a specific goal. We've taught the millennials that there's more to life than work. We've taught them that it's okay to just give it your best. And now we have to lay out some new rules, if you will, about what works in the workplace, which is not necessarily leaving at 5 to go have drinks with your friends at the West End.
Well, the irony here, Cheryl, is that all the things that we as parents have taught these millennial kids, all the things about balancing your life and all that, they seem to have backfired because now they need to sort of be re-educated. Did we spoil an entire generation?
Oh, I hardly so. I think that one of the things, if you look at what a giving generation this is, I hear case after case of kids who are viewing their personal success as how much they're giving back to the community, what kind of social entrepreneur they are. It's just that how do you balance that with goals of them wanting to also be successful in the workplace? One thing that was funny about the response that I received, and I got quite a bit of response to the series, was that several millennials emailed me about their personal success and how hard they worked and da-da-da-da-da. And then they said, but all my friends are like, which you described.
So there are some exceptions. But, well, I want to talk about the whole generation thing. These guys are in their first jobs for the most part. They're young people. When your generation came on the scene, you entered this paternalistic workforce and you changed things and you made things different. My generation, who had been raised as latchkey kids, we were the ones who didn't want to follow the old rules. We wanted to create our own system. Now we're called self-starters. What do you think, ultimately, once the millennials have a little bit of experience and time under their belts, what will their greatest contribution be?
I think it will be the social element of the social business person, the generation that wants more than monetary success. I think it's odd that I interviewed one millennial whose parents she said described as 60s hippies, and she has adopted many of their beliefs, but she's also headed to Princeton Law School. So I think it's a fascinating generation, and certainly. They're 27. The eldest are 27, so they really are just getting into the corporate world. And I'm told that we're about to the cutoff of this generation, that there's seeing signs of little differences in kids that are now 4, 5, and 6, which you have to get a little older. So I think that the people that are in their early teens now will be the defining of this generation, and I think that they're going to be politically attuned. I think you saw that with the number of young people that came in Dallas to see the Obama rally.
So it's going to be exciting to watch them grow.
Yeah.
All right. Cheryl, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
You can read Cheryl Hall's series on millennials online at dallasnews.com. For free video and audio podcasts of this week's programs, you can go to kera.org/think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perro Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perro Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. And by the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive.